Blog Talk Radio.
General Quarters, Security Condition 3.
EQ, Security 3, sir. General Quarters 3, intruder alert. EQ 3, intruder alert.
Okay, it's not an intruder. Oh, dear. It's not an intruder. Thanks for letting him in. Hi, good evening, everyone. Welcome again to Madame Perry Salon. I am your host and cruise director, Madame Perry, also known as Jennifer Perry, and I am so glad that you're here. If this is your first time to Madame Perry Salon and you're listening live tonight, November 1st, please click the follow. If you're listening on the Blog Talk Radio link, please click the follow and follow me so I can keep up with who's listening, so I can keep bringing you really fantastic guests like I'm bringing to you tonight. This has been, it's like all the guests just keep getting better and better and better, and it's all thanks to you. And, you know, Madame Perry's kind of an armchair sociologist. Well, actually, after I went to college, I decided I'm an armchair ethnographer. But, you know, I like to watch and study people. And my guest tonight, he studied them. I hate to use a cliche or quote, but from a song title of a good friend of his, he's seen them from both sides now, from different things. And if you know, if you've seen all the social media and everything I've put out, you know that my guest tonight, I'm so excited, is Glenn Berger. Glenn, welcome to Madame Perry Salon.
Madame Perry, thank you so much for having me.
Well, you're so welcome. Just come into the beaded curtain and find a nice cushion to sit down.
Oh, yeah, I think I managed to squeeze my way in through that bottle, and this cushion is so... there's nothing I love better than a cushy cushion.
And you squeeze your way. Look at you. You're so fit and trim. You look so good.
Well, it's a good thing I've been going to the gym.
I can tell. Oh, I can tell. I know. You're married. I'm not married. But I'm on a diet, but I can read the menu. So I can tell you're fit. I can tell you've been going to the gym.
Thank you.
So delighted you're here. And I've been posting a few of your blog posts from your website too. And because they're very, very useful, very helpful for people, especially now that we've been losing so many icons. I think you did one after the passing of Prince.
Yes.
And probably to explain how rock stars, you know, we can't imagine the enormous pressure that they're under.
Absolutely. Artists suffer a lot of pain, however much their behavior may look bad to us, you got to understand what they're going through on the inside. It's a tough life to be an artist, and they give us so much. They contribute so much to our culture.
Yeah, you're so right. They do contribute a lot, and you know, we're thinking about when people say everything about talk about Elvis. When you think about his kind of fame, who did he have ahead of him to help him, you know?
Right.
Like,
yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I think that there is a long history, but I think when you're at that level of fame, you probably have a hard time trusting people, and there are a lot of people who are out there who just want to take advantage of you, and a lot of people do, and so it can be a very lonely life, too. You know, that cliche of it's lonely at the top, it can really be true, and I think somebody like Elvis probably spent a lot more, and Prince. Prince died, they both died alone.
And that's very sad. Now, Glenn Berger's new book is called Never Say No to a Rock Star, in the studio with Dylan, Sinatra, Jagger, and more. And you've got a foreword in here from Judy Collins, who I've just gotten her new book too, Craving, so I can't wait to start that. But first of all, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
It's the winner of the 2015 Nicholas Schaffner Award for Music and Literature, isn't it?
That's what it is, yes. Yes, I was very honored to receive that.
Well, you've had you've had quite a fantastic life. I was watching a video, and I think I posted it today, too, from an event at the Cutting Room.
Yes, yes. It was really an amazing night. I was lucky enough to work in one of the greatest recording studios in the world, a place called A&R Studios, in the halcyon days of the music business, the 1970s, when New York was really at its peak. And we were making so many great records at that time with so many extraordinary artists like Dylan and Jagger and Sinatra and Paul Simon and Bette Midler and Steely Dan and so many others. And the real heroes of my story were the studio musicians behind the scenes. You wouldn't know their names, but they were responsible for so much of the music that we love. And so on September 29th, in order to celebrate the release of my book, I had a reunion of all of those New York studio cats. We had over 40 musicians and singers. It was an incredible night. There was so much love in the room that night, and some of the people hadn't seen each other in decades because that scene just doesn't exist anymore. And we had Paul Schaefer in the World's Most Dangerous Band from the David Letterman show, and Valerie Simpson, who wrote the song Ain't No Mountain High Enough, and she sang that song for us, and a lot of other great players and singers. It was an incredible night of music and love, and I'm so thrilled that I was able to put that together and be a part of that and celebrate the book that way.
That was probably like a family reunion for these guys, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was extraordinary. And each one of these characters, if you knew them, every one of them has a great personality, and they're so funny and so deep and have such beautiful hearts and are amazing musicians. So it was really a dream come true for me to be able to get back together with all my old friends again.
Now, Glenn, you were 17 years old when you started there at A&R Records?
A&R Recording, yeah, I was 17 years old. I don't know how I did that, but I was right out of high school. And at that time, in the early 70s, you couldn't go to school to learn how to be a recording engineer, which is what I wanted to be. You had to get an internship at a recording studio and work your way up from the bottom. So A&R had two studios in New York. One was at 52nd Street and 7th Avenue, and the other was 48th between 8th and 9th Avenue. And my first job was called Schlepper. And the Schlepper pushed a hand truck of audio tapes, big audio tapes, from one studio to the other across Midtown Manhattan. And at that time, New York was a dangerous place. So if I made it from one end to the other without getting mugged or somebody threatening me with an axe, it was a good day. You know, that's where I got my college degree from Screw University. You know, don't mess with me in the street. And that was my first job. I was making $80 a week, 64 take home after taxes, and I worked my way up from there.
Yeah, I shouldn't be laughing at that.
It was fun, you know.
Yes, I think about when I'm reading the book, I'm thinking about this, all the stories you're telling, and you paint it so beautifully. And yeah, I'll spend a lot of time in New York, but not back in those days. I had never been there, so I just couldn't even imagine just the when you're talking about getting the hand truck with the tapes, and you got to schlep it down a block to another building, and then make sure nothing happens to it. And if it wasn't for your life being, you know, possibly threatened on the streets, there was also threats when you got back. You know, like you better not lose anything, you better not mess anything up, because you were the slave, really.
Oh yeah, yeah. I was the guy at the bottom of the totem pole, and it was a pretty rough scene in the studio as well, where if I screwed something up, I somebody would pick me up and spin me through the air. But you know, the thing about it was that there was the guy that ran the studio, the R of A&R, was a man named Phil Ramone. He's a legendary Lifetime Achievement Grammy Award winning producer engineer. He was responsible for all of Billy Joel's hits and many of Paul Simon's, and the last things that he was working on before he unfortunately died a few years ago was Tony Bennett. And he's worked with so many incredible artists and made so many great records, and really is a legend in the business. And he was my mentor. He was the R of A&R, and he had this standard of excellence. which was imbued throughout the staff of the place. So we didn't have the fanciest equipment, certainly we didn't have the fanciest furniture, but we had the most incredible staff, all who were trained in the Phil Ramone way, and that's where the title of the book comes from, because the first lesson that I learned in the studio on my first day of internship was, you know, two rules. One, keep your mouth shut, which I don't think I ever learned that rule well enough. And rule number two is, no matter what anybody asks, your only answer is yes. And that was the way things were. So if I was in my first job, if I was stocking the rooms and there was a pencil stub that was, you know, that wasn't sharp, I would get abused. There's only one way to put it. But I learned that's pride and a standard of excellence that's held me in good stead, and that's how we made great records.
Yeah, and I saw that. I felt that when you were talking about things, you know, every little thing. You meant literally every little pencil stub. Everything had to be sharp in perfect place, cleaned up, tidied up. But then again, it was that standard of excellence.
Yes. Yeah, you know, they would say if the ashtray is dirty, how can you trust the pilot of the plane? And it was really the first person, the person who answered the telephone, and the kid who made the tape copies were the most important thing, because if the person who answered the phone didn't do it right, the client wouldn't come in, and if the tape copy wasn't right, it didn't matter how good our work was, the client would leave with an inferior product. So everybody that worked at the studio was important, from the schlepper at the bottom of the totem pole to the biggest recording engineer at the top. We were all part of this incredible mission. We were all on a mission to make great music, and we did.
Now, Lynn, how did you go to then you became Phil Ramone's assistant?
Yes. So Phil had worked with his personal hand-picked assistant, and I was, even though I wanted to move up the ladder from schlepper to assistant engineer, that was the next rung on the ladder. I certainly did not want to work for Phil Ramone, because he was not only had this standard of excellence, but he was notorious for eating assistants for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. He was like the giant in the Jack and the Beanstalk, and so he was a very scary guy, and so there were other great engineers, and I would have been happy to work with them, and I would sneak into the studio on the weekends to practice, and I'd get to the studio before everybody else and leave after everybody else left to try to get my chops together. And every once in a while, when there was no assistant available, I would be put in to work on a session, and I'd always screw something up. And whenever I did, of course, I would get yelled at terribly, and so I hoped that the day would come where one day I might be good enough to move up to the studio and stop pushing that hand truck around. And one day I was down in the tape library in the basement, which was where I had to spend my days, my miserable days between pushing the hand truck, and it was to get to the basement, you had to walk down this smelly staircase that was fetid with French fry grease from the corner coffee shop, and it was not a pleasant place to stay. And I just dreamed of taking the elevator up to the seventh floor where the studios were. And one day I get a call from the studio manager who says, "Glenn, everything is going to be okay." Now that didn't sound very good. I said, "What do you mean? What's happening?" He said, "Ramone's assistant is not available, nobody else is around, and you're going to have to cover the session." I said, I can't do that. I'm not ready. I He said, "Well, you don't have any choice. This is what's happening. Show up, you know, at the studio at 6:30 and set it up." Well, I called up my mom and I said goodbye, because I knew I was going to die that night. She didn't seem to be nearly as worried as I was. I went over there. I checked everything 5 times. And for the whole session, which was a demo for Lucy Simon, who was Carly Simon's sister, and Carly was there. She was very beautiful, great musicians. And I stood behind Phil like I was on first base about to steal second. If he just breathed, I was out in the studio moving the microphone or whatever it was that he needed. And somehow the 3 hours of the session passed, and we got to the end of it, and I didn't screw up one thing. I was so happy to be alive, because it was the first time that I assisted on a session without making some terrible mistake. Phil left, I just went home and I hoped that I would never have to see him again. I went into the studio the next morning and I walked into the main office and the guys in the office were razzing me as they would any day, and they were saying, "Oh, now you're Ramones boy, now you're Ramones boy." And I said, "Get out of here. I worked with him one time, it's never gonna happen again." And then the studio manager called me over to the scheduling book and he said, "Oh no, take a look." And Phil's assistant's name had been erased from all of his sessions, and my name was written in on all of his sessions. All day we were going to be working with Paul Simon, and at night we were working with an unknown artist named Phoebe Snow. We ended up making a hit record with Phoebe Snow, a song called Poetry Man, which is a very beautiful record. And that was how I got my start in the business. I was 18 years old. I was the luckiest boy in New York. I became Phil Ramone's personal assistant engineer.
How did you feel? I can't imagine.
You know, at that moment, I really felt that the hand of destiny on my shoulder. You know, there are a couple of moments in life where you are just given some golden opportunity, and hopefully you recognize it and are ready for it and seize it. And that was a singular moment in my life. I knew that was. I mean, obviously, to this minute, many decades later, I remember it. I remember that moment vividly. You know, I just feel so grateful to have been able to have that experience.
You know, you've got so many colorful characters that I want to hear about, but first I'm going to ask about some musicians. Now, you know, so once you got in there, I mean, like, I guess when you came in, everybody's razzing you, "Oh, now you're Phil's boy," whatever, you know, it kind of feels like, you know, guys on a schoolyard or whatever. But
right.
Then to see, you know, see your name in there, that had to have been a sobering moment. But you made hit records by day with Paul Simon. She started with that. Phoebe Snow, oh my gosh. I think everybody back then can remember when they first heard Poetry Man.
Really? Yeah. Yeah.
It was very enchanting.
Yes. Yeah. You know, Phoebe, and at that time, certainly along with the feeling of that I had been blessed by given this job, it was also very scary, and I did not know what I was getting myself into, and it certainly meant 20-hour days, and you know, I was just a kid working with these giants of the business, which could be quite intimidating. But Phoebe I kind of had a fantasy as a teenager, the name Phoebe Snow, what would she be like? And she came in and she was kind of this dumpy girl from Teaneck, New Jersey, and she was, I felt like she was the older sister that I never had, who just, you know, teased me and made fun of me. She was kind of obnoxious. But when she opened up her mouth and sang, it was something really extraordinary. And that record, Phoebe had given her producer a very hard time, and there was virtually no budget left. And in those days, in the 70s, people could spend a lot of money making a record. A guy like Paul Simon could take a year to make a record and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars. And Phoebe did not have any money like that. She was on a label called Shelter Records, which was about to go bankrupt. And we had 3 weeks to make this record with a very low budget. And Phil Ramone, who was co-producing it and really did the production on that record, said to Phoebe, "If you could have anybody in the world play on this thing, who would it be?" And Phoebe picked these choice jazz musicians, Teddy Wilson on piano, Zoot Sims on saxophone, and then we had some top studio ringers come in, Ralph McDonald on percussion. And these musicians were just the right people, the right setting for her songs. And I think because we had such a small budget, those limitations actually made the record a lot better, because a lot of things coming out at that time were very overproduced, and this was a very intimate record, a very personal record. And I think that's one reason it touched everybody's hearts when that record Poetry Man came out. It just spoke to people. And I think also because of who Phoebe was, she was a person who, she wasn't the most attractive or popular person, and she probably spent a lot of lonely hours in her room as a teenager playing her guitar and writing those songs. And I think she touched that part of all of us who feels like a misfit or doesn't quite fit in, or and she really spoke to so many of us at that time.
Amen. Yeah. So it's weird. Some things with music, you know, there's some things that there are music, and there are certain scents, be it food or fragrance or whatever, that you can hear or smell, and it is like you're transported, like you've done some time traveling. You can see and feel everything around. Yeah, I can even just think about that song or hear it on the radio, and I'm just back there. You know, I think of 1974, was it?
Exactly.
Yeah, I can still see, you know, just lay out on the grass and listen to that and just, you know, to people. And yeah, very, very enchanting. Now, so, you know, that was a word. Now, you got some other interesting stories too. Looks to me like, okay, I'm just going to put it right out there. I don't know how to segue into this, but tell us about your date with Bette Midler.
Okay, I will certainly do that. So we were working with when I was working with Paul Simon, for a short time he dated Bette Midler, but that didn't work out very well. I don't think that Bette was willing to put up with Paul very much, and we ended up working on some sides for Bette, and I was the assistant engineer. And Friday afternoon or whatever it was, it was my job to deliver a cassette, if you remember cassettes, down to Bette's apartment. She was living in Greenwich Village at the time on a street called Barrow Street. And I called her up to see when I could deliver the tape. And I don't know what possessed me as an 18-year-old or 19-year-old, however old I was at that time, what possessed me, what I was thinking. But I said to her, since I'm delivering this tape, do you want to go out? Do you want to go out on a date? And for some unknown and crazy reason, Bette said, sure. So there I was going down to the village with my cassette, little assistant engineer that I was, about to go out on a date with Bette Midler. So she was very charming. She was very funny. She's very smart. And we were having a great time. And we went out to dinner. We went to a place called Alfredo's. What was very popular at that time was Fettuccine Alfredo, which was pasta with cheese and more cheese. And, of course, we walked into the restaurant. I tried to get it. It was the most popular restaurant in the village at the time. I walk into the restaurant, and I get basically pushed aside, you know, this kid trying to get a table. And then they see Miss Midler, right? And of course, the C's part. Of course, Miss Midler, yes, we have a table for you. And, you know, she pushes out her famous breasts and walks to the table. And I'm, like, trying to pretend that I'm with her. Right. And I am so far out of my depth. I am just a babe in the woods. So I didn't know what anything. She said, you want to have some Chablis? I didn't know what Chablis was. I was just faking it all the way. You want to have an artichoke? How do you eat an artichoke? What do I know? Somehow I managed to get through the whole thing without looking like a complete idiot. I think maybe. And we went back after dinner. We went back to her place and we drank some more wine and we're dancing to Marvin Gaye. And then she said, do you want to watch some TV? I said, sure. I didn't know that her one and only little black and white TV was in her bedroom, and New York apartments at that time, bedrooms were very small. The only thing in the bedroom was a bed and the TV. So the next thing I knew, we were watching an old English comedy show called Monty Python, if you remember that, and I'd never seen that before. So it was a night of many firsts, and then I realized, hey, I'm in bed with Bette Midler. So what do I do now? So I thought, well, you know, I do know, I have had some practice kissing, so I think I can do that. And so I figured I'd see what would happen if I tried that, and she responded quite favorably. So we did that, you know, for a while, and then I realized, whoa, I'm in very close proximity. This is the divine Miss M to her, you know, the famous Bette Midler boobs. They're right there. Well, you know, I might as well see what happens. But then all of a sudden, it hit me. You know, what is the right next move? And unfortunately, a picture of my mentor, Phil Ramone, came into my head because I knew that he, you know, I was taught, you know, you never mess with the artists. So now I'm in a bind because one part of me wants to continue, but I don't know what the right thing is to do. And then I somehow come to the conclusion that the best thing to do is that the gentlemanly thing to do is to get up and leave. Well, let me tell you something. Hell hath no wrath like a woman scorned. Bette was pissed. And as I'm, you know, as I'm sort of realizing this and walking out of her apartment, I'm realizing that I've just made a hideous mistake that I can now not fix. It's like that car accident, you know, after you have the fender bender, you wish that you could go back and undo it, but it's been done. And So I think it makes a better story that I didn't follow through to the end, but certainly at that moment it was a very painful thing, and though I don't at this point regret what I missed there, I do regret that we didn't stay friends, because she was really a terrific person, and I know she's still a great person. So Bette, if you're out there, I love you.
Oh, you know, it's like, here it is. You want to be, you know, you're thinking you're being the gentleman, and yet she's thinking you're being a tease, probably. And you're right.
I was the roadie of the night, you know. I was the boy toy of that minute. That was it.
Never say no. Well, and I'm so glad, though, that you said, you know, you wish you would stay friends and you would like to, because I have a dear friend, Eric Reed, who worked for her. Now, he's a recording engineer. But when he first moved to New York, he worked for Bette in her parks, you know, the restoration project, New York Restoration.
Right.
And he worked for her, and he was such a fan. He would send me pictures whenever she had a party. You know,
right.
She'd have everybody, all her employees, along with the celebrities, very egalitarian. So he'd send pictures of himself with Donna Summer and Bill Clinton or whatever. But
right.
He said, you know, he said, Bette, let me... she would even let me use the company truck to go get some paint to do my apartment with, and bring my pug Lucy to work with me in it. And I thought, now what can you? She would come in and give me popcorn and my paycheck. What more could you ask? You know?
Exactly. Exactly. She was a terrific person, and she is. I mean, she's clearly dedicated to a lot of very good causes, like the ones that you're talking about, and she's still. She's still out there, and she's still doing it, and she's got a great personality, and she's a star. She's a real star.
Okay. Now,
so I just have to tell you the coda to that story, just to further embarrass, as if I haven't embarrassed myself enough with that story. At the same time, I was assisting on an album for Steely Dan, an album called The Royal Scam. In fact, I just saw Steely Dan at the Beacon. They were really terrific just a few weeks ago. And Walter and Donald, who were the two guys from Steely Dan, were very, very acerbic, very funny guys, very sweet guys too. And at some point, we were working on the thing, and Bette came in to visit, and she came up to me and gave me kind of a hug, and she said, Buns, because that was her name for me, Buns. Well, and when Donald and Walter from Steely Dan heard this, they just thought this was the best thing that they had ever heard in their life. They would never let me live it down. And in fact, if you look on the credits of the Royal Scam album by Steely Dan, on the very bottom under Techno, the very last credit is Buns. So that's my one credit with that name on a record album. Nobody knows that. Well, now everybody knows that's me, but you know, for a long time that was my secret identity.
The secret's not now. Hey, this is Madam Perry. I'm talking with Glenn Berger, actually Glenn Berger, PhD, about his book, Never Say No to a Rock Star. And if you want to call and ask him a question, talk to him. The number is 646-716-9922. That's toll free in the continental U.S. It's 646-716-9922. You can tell he's very easy to talk to. And Yeah, you're welcome. Questions, don't you, Glenn?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, he's already told you he's got buns, so.
Right. There's nothing left.
Really? What's left? What's left? Now, I got to tell you, I'm not going to tell you why I thought this because it might sound wacky, but I always had a feeling Paul Simon was just a bit of a jerk.
Unfortunately, it's true.
Oh.
Yeah. You know, I hate to bring down people's idols, and let me say, I love Paul's music. I think he's an extraordinary artist. I was just listening to some of his music earlier today, and really, I the first album that I worked on was a live album of his called Live Ryman, where I really got to immerse myself in some of his greatest songs, and I really came to admire him as a songwriter and as an artist. But unfortunately, just because somebody's a great artist doesn't necessarily make them a great human being. I didn't call Paul a jerk. I just corroborated what other people have said, and many other people. A guy from Los Lobos used a different word other than jerk, and he was not well regarded by a lot of folks, and he could just be quite cold. He was so focused on making his music that I think he didn't really notice that there were other people in the world who had feelings and things like that, and there are many stories and some that I can't even tell because I've been sworn to secrecy. But the one that I usually tell is when in 1979, after I'd become a senior mixer, I was engineering some of the solo album for Karen Carpenter. And Karen was in very bad shape at that time. As you may know, she had anorexia, and she was very, very thin and clearly not in good shape. And this was her first foray away from her brother Richard, who was nursing a Quaalude habit back in California at the time. She was with a whole new production team. Phil Ramone was producing the record, and she was working with Rod Temperton, who recently died, who wrote a lot of great songs for Michael Jackson and a lot of other great folks. But still, it was we all knew that how fragile she was. Now, when she sang, it was like the heavens opened. She was angelic. She had a most extraordinary voice. But my assistant would go there to get Karen from the hotel and try to get her to eat an apple or a banana or something before the session, and everybody was very concerned about her health and well-being. And we were working on some tracks, and Paul came in, and you could see this is the way the studio was, people visiting each other's sessions and stuff going on in all the different rooms. And Paul came in and asked, and I don't think he knew Karen very well at that time. Maybe he did, but it didn't seem that way. And he asked to listen to some tracks, and we played him some stuff. And when it was done, he turned to Karen. He said, "Karen, this stuff is awful. This is, what are you doing? This isn't what your audience wants to hear." Now, he may have even been right musically. I'm not going to make a judgment about that. But, you know, I'm a psychotherapist now, and I know that from a human point of view, you couldn't have done something that would be more hurtful and damaging to anybody, and especially somebody who was so fragile and in such bad psychological and physical condition at that point. So, you know, I don't know what he was thinking, but he certainly it was a terribly insensitive thing, and he could be that way.
Yeah. Oh, how hard. And yes, you're right. She was very fragile. If you knew anything about her just from reading the newspapers, I mean, any articles about her, interviews, or the movies, the book, I think the book was the recent book was Little Girl Blue. And
right.
Yeah, Mama always liked her brother best.
Right.
And yeah, and Randy Schmidt, I believe, wrote that. And so.
Yeah, he's actually been in some contact with me. He was interested in the sessions that I worked on. So, yeah, and I mean, you just had to look at her and you knew. I mean, it wasn't it was no mystery.
And you were and you're right. It was just devastated her. Also, another friend of hers, Donnie Demers, that you may know.
I don't. Yeah, the name sounds familiar.
That she worked a musician that she worked with, and Yeah, what a heartbreaking thing, though. What? And you know, even if you were musically on top of something, you know, there's a lot to be said for delivery and diplomacy.
Exactly. There was a lot of other ways he could have communicated that message. If he thought it was that important, he could have pulled Phil aside. He could have said, "That sounds great, Karen." And then later on, he could have gotten together with Phil and spoken to him privately. And there are lots of other ways to do that. You know, and for a guy who was as smart as Paul was, and he was a very smart guy, he could miss the boat on those kinds of things, and could. And sometimes it seemed deliberate. You know, I can't really say in that instance how conscious he was of what he was doing, but there were other times where he could be rather sharp. And in fact, Phil Ramon, who worked with, you know, a giant in the business, was intimidated by Simon. Just, you know, for me, as a 18-year-old kid working with the two of them, if Phil Ramone is scared of the guy, what am I supposed to think?
<You know>? Really? that's pretty powerful. That says it all.
Yeah, exactly.
You're just so much fun to talk with. You've got so much information. A couple of quick questions I'll ask you. Paul
sure.
Schaefer. Been a fan of his for years, watched him, seen some cute videos that he and Letterman made, read his book, We'll Be Here for the Rest of Our Lives.
Mm-hmm.
He as adorable as I think he is.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I had a great time working with Paul on his Coast to Coast album, and we worked on a track called What is Soul, and I got to the song was co-written and co-produced by Steve Cropper, who wrote Sitting on the Dock of the Bay and In the Midnight Hour, and Don Covey, who wrote Chain of Fools, Aretha Franklin's hit. And he came to this gig that I did a couple of weeks ago, and I hadn't spoken to him in quite a long time. And before the gig, he called me up and he said, "Glenn, you know, I've been meaning to call you for a long time, and you know, I heard about your book, and I was a little nervous to read it." Because I didn't know what you were going to, you know, if I was going to be in there, and if I was, what you were going to say. And he says, and I got through the Paul Simon chapter, and that was a little scary. And then there's a chapter that's called The Pricks and the Gems, and he read that one, and he wasn't in that one, so he was okay. And then he gets to the chapter. There is a chapter in the book about Paul, and the title of the chapter is The Night That Paul Schaefer Almost Got Me Killed. And he says, "Uh-oh, here it comes." But I only say good things about Paul in that chapter, and he really was a delightful guy, and such an amazing musician, and what a great person. I mean, he came and played at this thing for me, and they did amazing versions of the songs, You've Lost That Love and Feeling, and Gimme Some Lovin', and you can watch the videos on YouTube, and they're just mind-boggling, and his talent is extraordinary, and he's beloved by everybody. He's just such a great guy. So when we were working on that Coast to Coast album, his dream was to bring together what was called the Soul Clan. In the 1960s, the top R&B singers from Atlantic Records came together to make one record, and they never got back together again. And so many people wanted to bring these guys back together. Nobody was able to do it, but Paul was determined to do it for this track that we were cutting on this record called What is Soul. And he was doing a pretty good job of it. He got Benny King in to sing on it, who did Stand By Me, and Bobby Womack, who wrote the first Rolling Stones hit. And then it was time for Don Covey. This guy Don Covey, I love Don Covey. He'd come into the studio every day and he'd say to me, "Glenn," and I'd say, "Don." He'd say, "Are we going to make history today?" I'd say, "We're going to make history." And then when he'd finish an anecdote, he'd say, "This time I'm not lying." Right. So anyway, Don goes out in the studio to do his vocal, and I hit the record button, and it looks like he's singing, but the needle isn't moving. Now, I know I checked the microphone, you know, a dozen times. We can't figure out what's happening. Finally, we realize that he's moving and he's grooving, he's moving his mouth, but he's not making any sound. He's not singing anything. So when the take comes to an end, Schaefer gets on the talkback and he says, Don, that was a really good one, but can we just do one more to see if we can top it? So then the next guy to come in is Wilson Pickett, you know, the wicked Mr. Pickett, you know, a guy who invented rock and roll, right? Wilson Pickett in The Midnight Hour, Land of a Thousand Dances, Midnight Mustang Sally. And but he's got a reputation, you know, and the studio could be a dangerous place. Buddy Rich, the drummer, once threatened to kill me if I didn't put a microphone where he wanted it to put. So, you know, I was always a little cautious, and Wilson had a reputation. I'd heard a story that he had a fight with his bass player and knocked his bass player's eye out with a fireplace poker. So Wilson goes down in the studio, and he does his vocal. And Paul hits the talk back when it's done. He says, you know, Wilson, that was great. There's just one line I'd like to redo. Before Paul was even finished with the sentence, Wilson throws off his headphones, comes running into the control room, grabs me by my shirt, sticks his finger in my face, and starts screaming, you're plucking now, you're chicken plucking. Well, I don't think he could tell one bald-headed Jew from another. So I immediately threw Paul under the bus. I said, Wilson, it wasn't me, it was that one, it was that guy. Well, finally, there was one guy left, and if we could get this guy on the record, Solomon Burke, then he would have reunited the Soul Clan. Now, I'd worked with Solomon on a record a couple of years before, King Solomon Haile Selassie Burke. He had a wife and a Cadillac in every city in America, so that when he was on tour and he landed in Chattanooga, there'd be a car and a woman waiting for him. So I loved Solomon. We, you know, his big song was Everybody Needs Somebody to Love, and he was going to provide it for, you know, half the women in America. So Paul gets Solomon on the phone. I'm very excited we're going to get Solomon to come in. And Paul comes back after the conversation. He's dispirited. And we say, what's wrong? What happened? He says, Solomon said not only is he not singing on the song, but he claims to have written the song, which he didn't. And if we use it, he's going to sue. So we never got Solomon Burke on the record. Now, you may think that I'm making this stuff up, but I'm telling you, this time, I'm not lying.
It sounds too far-fetched not to be true in your world. Right. I don't know.
Exactly.
I don't know.
You know, when I was writing the book, when I got to a point after writing a chapter where I was saying, you know what, this couldn't have possibly have happened, I knew that I'd nailed it. But it's all true. It all happened.
That's so crazy. I'm still thinking about you threw poor Schaefer under the bus, for real.
Right.
Talk about you know, I've got to ask you about Dylan and Jagger, and I know you don't have a lot of time, and I could talk to you for so much longer, but you were talking about Bob Dylan. One of the stories in the book was about didn't they have you pull together a band?
It was actually Phil Ramone. You know, Dylan was so disinterested in the production of his own album that the day came for the recording, and he just turned to Phil, who was the engineer on the record, wasn't even producing it, and said, you know, get a band for me. And it was the Jewish New Year, so there weren't a lot of guys around, and Phil just happened to see Eric Weisberg in the hallway. Eric Weisberg was a great player and had a band called the Deliverance Band. He played the soundtrack for that movie. And I brought that, and so Eric got his band together and came into the studio, and everybody was very psyched. Now, these guys, you know, these studio musicians, they were pretty blasé usually, because we worked with the greats every day, you know, big deal. But Dylan was something different. You know, this was, we were going to be working on the new Bob Dylan album. The energy was just absolutely incredible. And now, there was no arranger or producer on the thing. So the guys were going to come up with what were called head arrangements. And what that meant was that Dylan would teach them his new songs, and they would come up with their own parts. And, you know, this usually took the good couple of hours for the guys to come up with just the right setting for a particular tune. They had to really learn the song and get into it, and there'd be a collaboration going on. Well, Bob starts playing the first song, and the guys just begin to learn the chords, and Dylan runs through it maybe one or two times, and the third time, he starts playing a different song without telling anybody. So the guys make mistakes. They play the wrong chords, and as soon as one of them makes a mistake, Dylan just waves him off like he's swatting off an annoying gnat. Tells him to stop playing. He plays this song once or twice, and then does the same thing again, starts playing a third song. Again, the guys screw up. Before you know it, all the musicians are sitting behind their instruments silently, and the energy, the excitement, the thrill that they're going to be playing on the new Bob Dylan album turns into the sadness that they are not going to be playing on the new Bob Dylan record. So we end up making the whole record with just the bass player sitting inches from Dylan, watching his hands on the fretboard of the guitar, trying to figure out what the next chord is the guy is going to play. And we make the whole album like that in a night. Now, as I said before, Simon could take a year to make a record, and he's making the whole thing in a night. He comes in two more nights and recuts the whole thing again two more times. What's going on here? Well, but the songs were so incredible. So he's cutting this song called Idiot Wind. I don't know if you know that song, but it's probably the most painful song in his repertoire. And I can't believe that I am just inches from this guy. I can see the spit coming out of his mouth. New Bob Dylan song, incredibly powerful and gut-wrenching song. And he gets through the whole thing. And when it's over, there's always silence for a few seconds in the control room. Mm-hmm. And then he turns to us, and with a sarcastic snarl, he says, "Was that sincere enough?" What? Was that sincere enough? Now, you know, rock and roll was my religion at that time, and Dylan was in the pantheon, and the religion was about the truth. And here's one of the gods, and he's totally full of it. The guy kills his studio musicians with the aplomb of a psychopath. He cuts his album sloppily in a day and does it two times more. And now this, was it sincere enough? Man, that was a disillusioning moment for me. I got to tell you.
I love your use of language with the aplomb of a psychopath. Yes. Horrible. Never done anything like what you and your guys have done, but I've had a jazz band for several years, a jazz combo, and I've been where I've been with other bands or been called in to a fill-in for another chick singer, and I've seen people pull some tricks on each other on stage before, and it's just outrageous, you know, when you're, especially when you don't know them, and they're pulling stuff on each other, and I'm kind of stuck there, or they're yelling back and forth. It's just, you know, when I got a keyboard player and I'm singing as a horn of an Israel figure, I told you to shut up. No, you shut up, Leslie.
Right.
I'm in the middle of the two horns, and what? That was my solo you cut off. Well, you played your long Israel mouth.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I did. No, you were out there for 2 weeks on that solo last time. You hang up a little week. You know, it's just going on and on. It's just so, so, they could be pretty crazy. And yet, when you talked about, you said Jagger was there, and wanted to come ask you if he could come over and talk to Dylan, and kind of got the same, he didn't get a warm, fuzzy feeling.
Yeah, you know, Jagger was one of the most, he was as charming as Dylan was weird. And, and of course, there was again where we're working with Mick Jagger during the day and Bob Dylan at night. That was quite an exciting week for me. And Jagger asked to come over and see Dylan, so I escorted him over to the studio, and I think they'd met once or twice before that. That's what my Dylan freaks tell me. I got that wrong originally, and I was corrected about that. But it wasn't Dylan was just, I think now as a psychotherapist, I kind of think that Dylan might have been kind of had kind of an Asperger's disorder or something. I mean, you see that how much controversy has come up around him receiving the Nobel Literature Prize and the fact that he didn't respond to the committee, right? So, you know, certainly not responding to me or the studio musicians or even Mick Jagger, it doesn't seem out of character when you win the Nobel Prize for Literature and you don't respond to their telephone call.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I got a couple of callers in here, Glenn, and
great.
One of them, of course, is my BFF, and she's also the host of her own show, Everything Relationships, Kenya Colbert. Kenya, say hi to Glenn Berger.
Hi, Glenn. How are you tonight?
I am so great. So good to talk to you.
You as well. I'm enjoying the show.
Thank you.
Okay. You and are also very interesting and funny.
I'm telling you. So, and also we have a musician, a composer and filmmaker on the line. I believe that's who I have on the line, Vincent Lennon Bryant.
Are you talking about me?
I think
not yet. Talking about me. That's amazing, and it's amazing that you're talking about the Rolling Stones. This is really weird timing.
Why is that?
Yeah.
I was in 1979 at Bill's rehearsals at 333 West 52nd Street in New York City. The Rolling Stones had booked SIR rehearsals to do Saturday Night Live. Huge was their road manager. I was their technician for their rehearsals.
Wow.
Oh.
That's fantastic. Yes, at SIR, I know it well.
I wasn't at SIR. I was across the street. All the fans had blocked SIR.
Really?
They had pre-booked Bills, and we had a young intern who was a drummer named Patrick. And Bill said, "Oh, Vince, you better let Patrick work this tonight. It's rock and roll, and it's not up your alley." So I went home. I went up to the Upper West Side, 104th Street, to my Uncle Harold's house.
Right.
And I proceeded to hang out with my Uncle Harold, eat dinner my Aunt Gail made. God bless the dead. They're gone. I loved them. I missed them.
Right.
And I went to sleep, man. I had a Ballantine's ale, Ballantine ale, whatever they're called.
Right.
And I went to sleep. And my uncle woke me up at about 15, 20 minutes after midnight.
Yeah.
And I said, "What's wrong? What happened? What did I do?" You know, he goes, "Nothing, man. Bill called. He's on the phone. He said he's got a car downstairs for you. He said the Rolling Stones. You gotta go work the Rolling Stones. Something happened with Patrick." I said, and I was like, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Vince, look out the window," and it was 11 stories up.
Right.
And I looked down there, and there was this black livery car, you know, one of those, airport limousine cars.
Right.
And I got dressed, and he said, No. "You take a shower, man. You're going to work for the Rolling Stones."
Right.
I said, "No, man. I got it, brother. Uncle Hal was so cool, man." I said, "You don't understand. This is not a party. This is not I have to be there to lift equipment and move things and do things."
Right.
So I went down there, and they were still pulling SVTs up the freight elevator. Mr. Sampson was the freight elevator operator. He was
of course.
The custodian of the building.
Right.
And the first person I ran into was John Belushi, drinking Stolich Nyas straight out of the bottle.
Oh, my goodness.
And,
wow.
Yeah. The story ain't over, dude. This is one of the best stories I got in my life.
Right.
And Gilda Radner was there with Gene Wilder.
Right.
And the Rolling Stones, and Mick Jagger comes in, and Keith is there. He's so cool. And this is before Chuck Lavelle was their keyboard player.
Right.
So the first thing I had to do was set up the Fender Rhodes or the Wurlitzer and some other things. A B3 I had to roll in, and one thing at a time, and Mick Jagger kept calling me Chubsy Ubsy.
Right.
What did he call
you? He called me Ginger.
He called me Chubsy Ubsy. Chubsy Ubsy.
You're Chubsy Ubsy, and then he calls Glenn Berger Ginger.
Wow.
Ginger.
And Charlie, wait. I mean, it was a great time. And they did Beast of Burden about four or five times, and they did Beast of Burden on Saturday Night Live that weekend.
Oh, that's
and,
fantastic.
I remember Bill. Yeah, I was their sound man. Bill Sonnenberg was one of the first. It was one of the first jobs I had. I worked for Lonnie Liston Smith, Stevie Wonder, Chic, Nile Rodgers, and Bernard Edwards, and E-Man Boogie. I mean, I worked for a bunch of different people, but the Rolling Stones was the most memorable rehearsal that I did.
Absolutely, they were so great, and it's so wonderful that you were part of that scene and that you got to experience that. You know where it was. You should read my book, man, because it'll take you back.
I would love to read that book.
Yeah.
I would love to read that book, man, because I came to Atlanta in 83, and I've got more stories to tell. I ended up being Angie Bowie's musical director, David Bowie's.
I met Angie Bowie. She wanted to be on my TV show. I met Angie Bowie, but we'll talk about that later, Vincent. You've been holding out on me. Okay, you've been really
I know. I, you know what? I'm 57. my kids are all grown, and they don't even care about these stories, so I never get to talk about this.
Exactly. You know? That's why I had to write the book, because they just would roll their eyes when I would tell these things. So I had to bring them to that gig I did a couple of weeks ago, so they would actually know that it was, these stories were not made up. You know, who wants to hear old dad's war stories from the old days? But that's so great that you were there.
Yeah, man.
And you can confirm that Mick Jagger was a great guy.
He was. They were the nicest guys. I mean,
yeah.
They had jokes left and right, and they were nice, and they were real, real professional musicians.
Yes.
Rehearsed. We got out at about 4:30 in the morning. The Saturday Night Live crew that would stop through, they were the crazies. These guys were like pros. They were doing their gig.
Right.
You know?
Exactly right. Yeah, and that combination of professionalism and being really good guys. And, you know, I would always judge, as I'm sure you can understand, you'd always judge the artist by how they treated the guy at the bottom of the totem pole. You know, the guy pushing the B3 or you know, setting up the tape machine. And that's where Mick really showed his character.
Yes.
He was so sweet and kind to me, even though I was assistant engineer and you had the same experience. So, you know, those are memories that you get to hold forever.
Yep, and then years later, he worked with, they came to Phil Ramone's A&R studios, the Wheels. What's your name again?
Glenn Berger.
Glenn Berger. Did you know, what's his name?
Jim Boyer?
I know who Jim Boyer is. There's another name. He did the Thundercats. That was one of my buddies. Oh, God.
Oh really?
I can't remember his name.
Right.
But Ollie Cotton was my main buddy. Ollie Cotton and Chaz Lipton.
Yeah, both of those guys were trainees of mine. I trained both of those guys to be engineers.
Wow.
I saw Chaz just a couple of weeks ago, and Ollie was a good friend of mine. So that's wonderful.
Yeah, man. Yeah. That New York scene. Can't get rid of it.
Yeah.
Okay, so. Sorry, let me just jump in to say, if you're just tuning in or just tuning a little bit kind of listening, this is Madam Perry Salon. I am talking to author and psychotherapist Glenn Berger about his book Never Say No to a Rock Star, about the days when he began working at A&R Studios in New York City at the tender age of 17 back in 1974, when he worked with Simon, Dylan, Jagger, Sinatra, Burt Bacharach, Bette Midler, James Brown, all these people. I've got a couple of questions I want to ask, and I'm going to give them to you quick so that you can file them away. One is, after all the things with people who took forever and ever and ever, or people like Dylan who played little games with people to aggravate him, you know, you say that one of the easiest sessions you did was with Frank Sinatra. I want to ask you that. And then after that, because you left that and then you became a psychotherapist. And folks, get the book Never Say No to a Rock Star by Glenn Berger. And I've been putting up the videos from the Cutting Room event recently. I've been putting those up on Facebook and Twitter and different social media. Go check those out. Get the book. But also check out his website. And the website is
GlennBerger.net.
GlennBerger.net, GlennBerger.net. And so if you want to call and get a quick question or comment to Glenn Berger at 646-716-9922. So my questions were going to be about Sinatra, and what was it that prompted you to write this book after all the years being away from that business? So pick whatever question you want.
Yeah, so Sinatra talk about professionalism. He had a reputation that he could be very rough in the studio, but it wasn't that he was capricious. He was the best, and he demanded the best. And so we worked he was coming in to do a vocal overdub on a song called The Saddest Thing of All, and we wanted to be absolutely, this was the test of our training, was whether we could handle Sinatra. And I was working with another trainee of Ramone's, a guy named Rich Blakin. And Sinatra came in and ran through the song for us one time so we could set levels. And what was amazing was that he could get louder, but the needle wouldn't move. He had this extraordinary mic technique and better than anybody that I ever saw. And I think that had a lot to do with how he sounded on record where it was like he was singing right into your ear. It was a very intimate, sexy kind of sound that, that Sinatra had, and, among his many other great qualities as a vocalist. And did the whole thing in one take, came into the control room for a playback, and you know, it was a sad song about passage of time and loss. And I thought about my dad, because my dad had died when I was 15 years old, and he was a big fan of Sinatra's. He kind of reminded me of Sinatra and being a guy from that generation. And,
wow.
And I know how proud he would have been to know that his son was there pressing the buttons for the chairman of the board. And
sure,
you know, that brought a tear to my eye. And when it was over, he was satisfied with what he'd done, and he did a beautiful rendition and shook our hands and said goodbye, gentlemen. The whole thing was over in a half an hour. And, you know, now all I have are my memories of those days and my memory of my dad. And to me, that's, you know, that's the saddest thing of all. Yeah.
That's
so
awesome,
and I wrote the book because I, as a psychotherapist, I was working with a guy who brought in some music for us to listen to together because he thought it was a way for him to have a kind of an emotional breakthrough. And what we didn't expect was what happened to me. We were listening to Aretha Franklin's "Bridge Over Troubled Waters," which had been written by Paul Simon, and in the middle of the song, I found myself covered in tears. And it was a strange feeling. I didn't know what it was exactly. It wasn't sadness. And then all these memories started coming up from the early days. And I decided that I'd start to write those stories down to try to figure out what the feelings were about. And it took me the whole book to figure that out. But what it was remorse, and it was gratitude, and it was grief. It was remorse because I never really appreciated the extraordinary gifts that I had received from these people in the music business who so generously welcomed me into this amazing world of music. And I never properly said thank you or I love you. And I wanted to do that. And I felt gratitude that I have these experiences, like what we're talking about with your Stones rehearsal. These are memories that we'll cherish forever. And lastly, the grief that the scene is gone and it's never coming back like our youth.
It's
gone. And I realize after all this time that I miss it. You know, I miss it in the core of my being.
How about that? It's all Pro Tools now. These kids, you buy it in a box. I just left for a Guitar Center.
You got it.
All right.
Yeah.
So, and that's what then King and I were talking about too, because she's a life coach. But Glenn, you were saying that that you were there with your client, and the client asked you, you know, can I just bring in some music to help you understand how I feel? And boy, did he pick the right person.
Really? Yeah, you know, I do work with a lot of artists and use music in my sessions in ways like that, and that's one way that this particular client and I really relate and connect, because he's a huge Aretha Franklin fan, and so am I, and you know, however you connect to your art to the clients that you work with, you know, the thing that Aretha does is she opens up her heart all the way, you know, and that's what I try to help my clients do.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
Did you have
Glenn, excuse me, I'm sorry. Did you grow up in Queens, Glenn?
Say that again?
Did you grow up in Queens?
No, I grew up in Brooklyn. I'm a Brooklyn boy.
Okay, all right. I grew up in Queens in Springfield Gardens.
Right.
Yeah, okay. We got such going on, similar stuff.
Exactly.
Wow, that's awesome.
Well, I'm going to say, and I know I have to let you go, Glenn, but I just want to say again, thank you so very much for writing this book, for sharing, and also because of the posts that you have. And remember, when you listen to this, of course, this podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Blog Talk Radio, and Blueberry as a download for, I guess, as long as such equipment and things last. But
for all of eternity.
All of eternity.
Well, there you go.
Wow.
I love that.
Well, this was so much fun. I really had a great time doing this, and thank you so much for having me on and for chatting with all of you. This is really really a delight.
I would like to get in touch with you, Glenn.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Just go to my website, and you can find how to get in touch with me there. Go to glennberger.net, and go to Amazon and get the book.
I'm going to get the book and do all of that. Are you in New York?
Yeah.
I'm in Atlanta.
I am. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm in New York.
I'm in Atlanta.
Okay. Wonderful.
Or you can give me $50 for a phone number. But anyway, glennberger.net. Get the book, Never Say No to a Rockstar. Go to his website.
I love that title. I love that title. That's awesome.
He's got so many. In the studio, Never Say No to a Rockstar, in the studio with Dylan, Sinatra, Jagger, and more by Glenn Berger, by Dr. Glenn Berger. It's available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, IndieBound, wherever fine books are sold. If it's not at your store, make sure they get it. But great book. I read through it and then started reading it again. Fantastic. Glenn, you're an absolute delight. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time and being my guest. And everybody, tomorrow night I've got Jennifer Irwin. She wrote a book called A Dress, The Color of the Sky. It's about sexual addiction. And it's already been set up for, she's already got signed off film rights to it. And so that's going to be fun too. Glenn, thank you. Good night. Glenn, please come back to Madame Perry's Salon. I hope you found your favorite cushion in here.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if I can get off that cushion right now. you might have to, I don't know. You're going to have to help me up.
Can you?
I got you.
All right. Good night, everybody. Thank you so much.
Good night.
Good night, Glenn. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you all for listening to Madame Perry's Salon. And I love you. Be good to each other.